All right, so this is Ryan Nilsson, and I'm about to ask some questions to Alex Jones, the North Carolina state coordinator for the state organizer for the National Farm Worker Ministry. We're sitting in Greensboro, North Carolina, at the National Farm Worker Ministry office here. It's about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on August the 2nd, 2011. So let's get started. So Alex, how did you first get involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
So I first heard about NFWM through David Wildman, who is a board member for National Farm Worker Ministry through the General Board of Global Ministries of the Methodist Church. He's also just an invaluable resource within the Methodist Church General Board in and of itself, and I was participating in a three-year mission program for young adults. And I was at the point of finishing the first half of the program, and David had suggested National Farm Worker Ministry as a possible site for the second part of my placement. So the mission program that I was a part of is a three-year peace and justice mission program for young adults in the Methodist Church. And essentially, you spend the first half living abroad and working in an area of conflict, and then you spend the second half in a domestic setting. And so I had been in the Philippines working with agriculture workers and had some options in terms of where I would transition back into a domestic setting. And so David had suggested National Farm Worker Ministry, and up until that point, I hadn't heard of the work that they were doing or the organization. And it seemed like a very natural fit in connection with the work that I was doing in the Philippines, working with people who lived in the countryside, working in agriculture, farm workers not owning their own farms, but also coming together collectively, you know, through the union movement and, you know, working with workers' rights.
Cool. So what was it about the National Farm Worker Ministry's work that you heard about at that point that made it seem like a natural fit?
Especially in terms of the mission of solidarity, that one of the core values of National Farm Worker Ministry is that we're an organization and a people within the church that work in solidarity with farm workers, that we take our direction directly from the people who are experts in their area, in the field, and in the fields. So that really resonated with me. Also, the idea of labor and workers' rights, and coming from a place where it's mostly still an agrarian society and the union movement is still relatively young in the Philippines, and with that comes some of the same authenticity of a young movement, but also some of the same challenges. And so as I learned about the work of National Farm Worker Ministry and about the farm worker movement in the U.S. in general, the likenesses and some of the same challenges were really, really resonated with me in the work that I had been doing. It was a very natural transition. And interestingly, though, the setting is different and there were cultural differences and aspects that were dissimilar, you know, the bulk of the work is really similar. In the U.S. still, the farm worker movement is a really young movement, and so I think it speaks to the need is so great that people need the protections of a contract and come together to be able to collectively unite their power, you know, to collectively bargain. And so, it was a very natural transition, minus the language part.
Yeah. So. And you came to this as a missionary through the United Methodist Church.
Right.
So how has your how have your beliefs or values kind of affected your involvement with the ministry?
Yeah, this is something that I think about a lot. I feel like on some level, this is kind of a full circle. Like, I grew up in an area in the Midwest with a family that was rooted in union struggles and workers' rights. And it's mostly an agricultural area there, too. And then to have gone into an international context and worked with people in that capacity, and then to come back here to the U.S. Again, really has given, you know, the same kind of, the same ideas. Like, I've been able to view it from, you know, very different perspectives. So the other part of my history, I think, that's important is that I was raised in a, somewhat traditional Methodist church, involved in mission work that was really formative for me when I was young. But the idea of justice and what it means to work for justice has evolved over time. I mean, it's taken years, and I think my work here with the National Farm Worker Ministry has just continued in that process of evolution for me. I think in the church, a lot of times we look at justice and we start to learn about justice through parables and through kind of theoretical and historical contexts. But justice as it's lived out is very different. It's harder. It's messier. Inevitably, we make mistakes. And it's a really humbling process. It's a thing, you know, when in our everyday lives, when we strive to work for justice, it's having hard conversations with the people that are closest to us sometimes, with our family members, with our, you know, people that we know from church, and then also having larger conversations against and with, you know, larger structures that are in place. It's work that isn't comfortable, but it's critical. And so I think that participating in the work of National Farm Worker Ministry, and especially in supporting the unions and organizations that we do that are led by the farm workers, that has just solidified that even more for me and helped me to understand, like, in the evolution of that process, what it means to every day try to live my life and to make choices and to speak out for justice. And that I think sometimes it's glorified a lot in, you know, in settings that we hear about it through the parables. It just sounds so right and so simple. And in everyday life, it's going against the grain. And that's what every single one of us is called to do by, you know, our various traditions.
Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah.
I mentioned that I might ask this kind of last minute, but the distinction between faith-based and faith-rooted organizing or justice work is something you've brought up in conversation to me before.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell me about how the work of the National Farm Worker Ministry and your experience is either faith-based or faith-rooted, and how that affects what it is that you're actually doing here?
I think that, you know, the idea of being driven by our faith, or, you know, people call it by different names. It's your faith or your values or sometimes goodwill, you know. It's something that's a core fundamental part of who we are. And so I think when we're driven by our faith, whether it's, you know, in my case, I was raised Methodist, and so I've studied the Christian Bible and the various resolutions and principles of the Methodist Church, which, you know, as a young Methodist person, and I think like a lot of people, I grew up in this tradition because it was my family's tradition, not because I really understood it. And as I grew to understand what Methodism means, you know, as especially in the context of the social principles and the resolutions that are passed and the way that it relates to our everyday life, that's whenever it really, like, Methodism came to life for me, right? So for me, in doing this work and being driven by my own faith that's come from these, you know, the learning that I've had or the experiences that I've had, I think it just means that everything that we do is tempered by that, right? So it's a constant process of reflection and evaluation and studying and learning and trying to understand what it is that the values that I have are calling me to do in every instance. You know, it's not something that you can just paint with a broad brush every single day with, you know, lots of encounters that we have. I think there are opportunities to act in a just way. And, you know, sometimes we are able to and sometimes we're not. And that's part of the learning process.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think so.
I think being rooted in faith or being based in faith in terms of organizing, I think means also that it's not just something that we're doing as a reaction. It's something that's deep within us that creates this drive, and it's relating to people on that level. You know, like recognizing that someone might be a mother and she might be a worker and she might be, you know, a daughter. And she's also a person who participates in her local congregation. Like, that's one aspect of her life, and that's how we relate to people sometimes, not singularly because that person, you know, goes to church, but in all aspects of her life, and that's what drives her to participate.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah.
Cool. So once you actually got involved with the National Farm Worker Ministry here in North Carolina. Did you come to North Carolina first, or did you? Okay.
Yep, I started out here. I drove here on January 27th, and I drove right into town, and Lori put me to work immediately. I had not even gone to where I was going to live. And she was like, okay, we've got a lot of work this afternoon. So I left everything in my car and went to the office at eRough and started in, and that was it.
Perfect.
Hit the ground running, yeah.
Nice. So can you share some experience, maybe a story of a specific situation with your work with the National Farm Worker Ministry that had a really significant impact on you? Maybe something earlier on, since we're
uh-huh.
talking about that early transition.
Yeah, I think there were two. When I first came, it was right around the springtime, and so within the first month or so, it was when people were just starting to come to North Carolina for the planting season. And, you know, I went through a process of learning. Even though I grew up in an agricultural area in Illinois, because of mostly having corn and soy, very few crops in the area where I'm from are hand harvested. So I had a lot to learn just in terms of kind of the lay of the land of what farm work is about and who does farm work and, you know, all the statistical kind of things that we work with churches and teach people about all the time. But the first experience that really stayed with me and has continued to stay with me is participating in the Pilgrimage for Justice and Peace within, I think it was in March that year. It was really early in the year. And we were in eastern North Carolina, and you know, part of what the pilgrimage does is, you know, walks throughout the day. I think we had walked 6 miles that day. And we ended up in the afternoon at the outskirts of a small town in a house that was empty. And we were in kind of a yard area. And we were told by the person who was leading the activity there that this was the house where a man had lived who had died in the fields the year before. So I had come in 07, and the couple of years before were really hot summers in North Carolina, and several people had died of either heat stress or, you know, essentially lack of water and shade in the fields. And so we had a ceremony that was part of this, part of the pilgrimage, where we had a pitcher of water, and each one of us poured out water and kind of offered up our hopes for, not just for this man and his family, but just also more broadly. And, you know, we learned about him and his family and the day that he died, and I think the reality and the gravity of his particular story was what stayed with me so much, because in my ignorance, thinking that this was impossible, you know? And so it was really motivating to me so that more people, you know, would know that this happens, that this occurs, and that, you know, this sacred person had died because he didn't have water. I mean, water is everywhere. And so that experience really stayed with me for a long time. I mean, in a way that I think for maybe the first year that I worked here, I made a promise to myself that, like, I just drank water. I only drank water so that I would always remember, you know. I guess just so that I'd always remember. But then the second experience.
Can I ask you before you, you can take a minute too if you want. But has that continued to be something that's been in it, like the deaths in the field due to water? Has that continued to be something in North Carolina that has been an issue in your time over the last several years? Or have there been significant efforts that have helped in responding because of these particular deaths when you first started?
I think yes and no is the short answer. There were definitely, I mean, there were groups, National Farm Worker Ministry, Flock, and others that, of course, tried to bring these stories, bring them to the light in the broader public. The short answer is there wasn't legislation that was passed. I don't know that enforcement on behalf of the government agencies has changed any. I think the reality is that here for a couple summers it was a little bit cooler. And so at least for two seasons after that, to my knowledge, no one's life was taken as a result of that. But certainly, you know, there were people who suffered from the heat. You know, I don't know the gravity of each person's situation. A couple of years ago in California, I think 7 people died in one season in California, and that's a state even where there are laws about shade and water. I mean, the issue is systemic, and the reality is this work will always be difficult and hot, but there are precautions that can be taken. And so, you know, it's a broad, multi-layered issue, but the fact that people are working, that they're in their job, and that a possible result of their job is that's going to be hard, isn't it?
Yeah,
that it's suffering from the heat, not because it's just hot, but because you're not able to stop when you want to stop or when you know your body needs to stop. You're not able to get water. And even if you are able to get water, you probably can't get it till the end of the row. You know, so even if you go every, you know, to every row and then get water, that's, you know, that's if you have a crew leader or a grower that allows that, you know. That's absolutely unjust. That basic human functions that our bodies need, that people have to struggle just to be able to have those. So I think a lot of times it's circumstances and stories like that that strike, you know, the human spirit, that, you know, that really touch us because they're, you know, they're shocking and they're appalling. But I think what I learned over that first year, I went to the very first workers' meeting that I went to was maybe 2 or 3 months later, and it was in the western part of the state, and there were probably about 35 people that came together, and it was a union meeting and a training, and Leticia, who was the vice president of the union and the director in North Carolina of Flock, she and the other organizers led some activities that day, and it became really clear when we were there that they were the ones facilitating the activities, but they were just the guides. And the people with the real answers and the real expertise were the workers that were there. They were the people making the decisions. And respect was absolutely inherent in the whole process. And I'm sure that plenty of people in that room had experienced similar situations in their work. It hadn't, you know, it didn't raise to the level of seriousness that their life was maybe threatened, but they were able to talk about those circumstances. They were able to talk about possible solutions and how to work together. And then in the meantime, you know, they also had fun and people laughed together and they got real together. And so I think those two experiences are really illustrative of kind of the spectrum of this work, you know, and the farm worker movement in general, that there are unfortunately stories that we can see every day that happen that are just, I think, that just affect us on a human level, that we can relate to people and just feel really deeply concerned and touched. But then on the other end of that is like the strength of the human spirit and people coming together and saying, this is not right and this is why. You know, I think it's really important. I don't know, in Christianity, maybe it can be compared even to like the resurrection, right? That we can't, as allies and as supporters, we can't stay in that place where we're incapacitated by grief or by just the difficulty of what people are facing in the fields, but that we have to move forward and support what changes are happening and the people that are leading those changes, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's been a constant process as I've been an organizer here, is coming to understand that. Like I said, growing up in a traditional church, it's not language that we learn every day, you know? It's, there are lessons, but the application of those lessons that we learn in Sunday school or, you know, in religious education, they're very different when you apply them. And especially in terms of our role as National Farm Worker Ministry and being support, it's trusting that the people who are working in the fields are really the ones that know. You know, they're the ones with the experience every day, and they're the ones that are going to lead the change, and we're going to support that.
And I'm kind of curious about that dynamic. Have there been times when that's been really difficult, or maybe convincing people in churches that you're trying to bring into this work? Has it been hard to get people to see that vision where you're looking for leadership or leadership from farm workers themselves?
Mm-hmm. I think inherently...
Hold on, one second. I'm gonna move this a little closer, just in case.
Okay.
Cool.
Can you see it? Inherently, I think that process is difficult for us as people. I think it makes it more difficult as Americans. Part of the reason I think it's a difficult process is because it's a humbling process to understand that we can't necessarily make that change. I would say that's the crux of our work as organizers with National Farm Worker Ministry, is to walk with people as they're growing in that understanding and to lovingly help develop and shape that within other people as we are within ourselves. I don't think anyone is born with an inherent understanding of what it means to live out justice. Maybe. but people are really lucky if they are. For me, it's been a struggle to understand what it means on a daily basis, and I think it is for a lot of the churches and the people in the churches that we work with. Like I was saying, you know, it calls for difficult conversations with people that we're the closest to, and to be able to reconcile that with those people. Sometimes it also means that we're not able just to fix something, that we, you know, it doesn't make sense to us sometimes that we can't put a large amount of money with something, or, you know, put a whole lot of energy into something and it's just going to change, you know, that. And the other part is, you know, there are language and cultural barriers that exist also. And that's also a really humbling thing. I think it's important and it's really good that a lot of times, you know, that in our everyday, in our work, we're kind of dominant society, right? A lot of the majority of the churches that we work with tend to be non-immigrant churches. And so kind of standing in the background in an active but supportive role, I think is a challenge a lot of times for people who are leaders in their lives. And it's kind of a servant leadership that we're called to do. And so I think that sometimes takes time and a certain like finesse to understand it.
Yeah. In some ways that might feed into my next question. How do you feel that you have changed? You're talking somewhat about how the process has been walking with people, mm-hmm. as they're seeing this transformation, mm-hmm. ideally. But how do you feel like you've changed through your work with the National Farm Worker Ministry?
Mm-hmm. I think it's just been part of my own process of evolving and understanding. The interesting part is that I'm learning as I'm also teaching, and I think it's important, again, self-evaluation is really important, to just be sure that you know, as I learn more, I'm able to teach better. But I think I've come to understand, like, some simple changes have been even being quiet when I want to speak and listening a little bit longer. A very fun and simple thing that I learned a long time ago. I went on, like, I've been to labor camps a lot, and sometimes I've gone out with organizers from the union over time, and that's been really helpful because, you know, when we go to labor camps, a lot of times it's to be that bridge between the people who are working in the farms and living in the labor camps, and then congregations for that exchange, right, for that contact and interaction and mutual learning. But when you go out and do outreach with an organizer or, you know, on a one-on-one basis, there are different conversations happen, of course. And so understanding that there are comfortable silences, and it's important to wait through those silences to build rapport and to connect with people. It's a really subtle thing, but it's something that has really stayed with me. Somebody explained it to me a long time ago and just said, you know, I think, especially in our lives right now, everything is go, go, go. We're very active. We're, like, time conscious, and we, you know, have a lot to do, and we have a short time to do it. And so, you know, a lot of times I think we focus on getting through our list, A to Z. And in organizing, it's not as simple as that. Sometimes getting from A to Z means sitting and waiting in uncomfortable silences, and then that's going to help to connect in a deeper way and give people the opportunity to speak up or not. So I think it's helped me to learn both on a, you know, personal individual basis to sit through uncomfortable silences, but also kind of in a larger scale, that sometimes there are uncomfortable silences that need to happen to help us grow and develop. So I guess the answer to that is I'm changing every single day and developing every single day. Sometimes it's a little bit, it's definitely humbling, but it's a little bit embarrassing to think about things that I've said in the past, very well intentioned, but recognize now how they might have been understood because I didn't have maybe the tools to express it in the way that I really meant it. I think there's a lot that we have to unpack in society, you know, a lot of perceptions that we hold about ourselves and about other people, especially when there's a cultural barrier or a language barrier. And, you know, we can remember people are people and, you know, remember a lot of the theoretical things that were taught, but when you put them into practice and really honoring another person and respecting another person looks different. So, yeah.
Nice. It occurred to me while you were saying that you'll have some of some of these words that you're saying now to look back at.
Right, exactly.
Maybe a few years from now with different tools.
I've done this before. It's always more embarrassing on tape because you think, oh, I really thought that. I was so convicted.
No, I think what you're saying is insightful, for sure.
You know, one thing to add to that, I think, is about voice. Just even semantics sometimes can make a big difference, because a lot of times we say, you know, we're speaking out for the voiceless. And this is a perfect example of something I had said in the past, that's a really common phrase. Like, we need, you know, farm workers are voiceless. And I have since come to understand how wrong that is, that it's one thing if people's voices are being silenced, but no human being is voiceless. No one is. And farm workers, you know, people who are doing farm work have a voice just as much as everyone else does. They might not be able to influence the legislature by their vote, but certainly it's our responsibility to listen to what people say and to be our own voices within our own communities too. That as an ally, that doesn't mean that we should be silent. It means that we need to speak up in our own communities. But, you know, just that, even that very simple concept of being voiceless versus not, you know.
You also have been talking a little bit about, I guess, coming to that realization about silence and voicelessness and voice. Everyone has a voice.
Right.
Through actually visiting labor camps. Can you tell me a little bit more about visiting labor camps or some particular story or experience you've had visiting labor camps in North Carolina?
Mm-hmm. I think everyone is different. One thing that we don't do, I think, as a society much is, like, sit on the porch with people in the way that maybe our parents or grandparents did. Just sit and talk, you know, maybe with an agenda or a particular topic that we come to talk about, or maybe with none at all. So that's an opportunity that happens, I think, when we visit people in labor camps. I mean, that even they're labor camps, but they're temporary homes, right? So, you know, we're visiting somebody at their home. I think every time I've gone, I come back with a different, you know, a different understanding or a deeper level of understanding. I got to know North Carolina in a really strange way. A lot of people, you know, you get to know a city or a neighborhood, and I got to know North Carolina when I first moved here by, you know, something Church Road, which is off of something other road, you know, and North Carolina has a lot of streets called Union Grove Church Road or Cedar Rapids, you know. So I got to know North Carolina in through tobacco fields and through driving, you know, in the evening time as people are leaving the city. We would leave the city, and, you know, there are very distinctive smells and sights and sounds. People mowing their grass in the evening, you know, the sun setting and it starts to get cool. They're like almost the routine, you know, in preparation for the work, right? Which kind of, on one hand, doesn't feel like work sometimes if you're talking with people, because it's really enjoyable, right? Like you had said, like, outreach is some of the most enjoyable time, because you connect with people and you get to know them personally, and then you get to also kind of in your mind kind of organize their own story, like their personal story, with what you've learned about kind of the greater context, right? So I think not one experience is coming to mind in terms of visiting people at labor camps, but what more broadly is coming to mind is developing friendships with people who are living dual lives. Flock works with a lot of people. I mean, the majority of Flock members are on the H2A program. So the majority of the people that I meet are here part of the year and in Mexico part of the year. And so some people that I would call friends that have, you know, been an important part of half of my year every year come and go. And so I think that is what has stuck with me the most. You know, the handful of people that I look forward to in the spring, like I feel myself anticipating their phone call. Like, oh, I wonder if so-and-so is back. Oh, I wonder, you know, like, did so-and-so's daughter graduate from high school? You know, did she make the grade? You know, like, when you get to know people's lives, and then this weird kind of juxtaposition by being in their home country, in their home state, in their hometown, living a life with their families, and then coming here and living with a group of men and cable, you know, like cable television. And I just imagine, like, half the year you sit and you have ESPN as your main source of entertainment, and then half the year you have the richness of your own food and your own culture and your own family. And so I've often said that I feel like some people, it just feels like there's a sacrifice generation. That one person I'm thinking of in particular, he's been coming for 25 years. He started coming when he was 20. He's now been traveling back and forth for more years than he didn't. And now his son comes here. And so it's, you know, now going into a second generation. And granted, I think his experience, part of the reason that he keeps coming back is because he's working in a farm that that it works for him, you know, that he can come here, he can earn enough money that when he goes back to his own farm, that he can pay people to work on his farm for the rest of the year. Which, you know, that's a good thing. But why can't he earn enough money where he is that he wouldn't have to come here and leave everything in order to be able to do that? So, you know, it speaks to a lot of larger issues of trade and economies, and, you know, people are doing what they have to do for their families, but that doesn't mean that in the meantime that their lives aren't forever changed. And I don't know, I hesitate to say that they're suffering, because I think people just learn to endure what's normal, you know, what becomes normal. But there's still a sacrificial nature of having to live half of your life in a full way, in the way that you choose, and half of your life in what I always say, like, labor camps. I think I've always related the very nicest labor camp I've ever seen was kind of like one of the worst church camps I've stayed at, you know? I wouldn't want to live in a church camp setting with a whole bunch of other people that are coming that I maybe just met for 10 months out of the year, and then, you know, for the other 2 months be able to visit with my family and, you know, like, live the life that I want. So that's what I think sticks with me a lot of times when I leave labor camps, especially talking to people that are in that situation, that go back and forth, you know, they're
I think bringing in the larger kind of trade and economic realities, and just kind of the just how huge some of this is.
Yeah.
Do you have ideas about some of the more, maybe the smaller, concrete changes that could really go a long way in North Carolina, or through the work of the National Farm Worker Ministry or FOC?
Yeah, I always call it the NAFTA can of worms, because once you start down that road, like, where do you go from trade policy needing to be changed? No, it's really big. I mean, there are successes all the time. I think there are small victories and medium-sized victories. I mean, even when you look at North Carolina, it's still amazing to me that North Carolina, which consistently competes, I think, with South Carolina to be the least and second least unionized state, right? That here, there's a contract that covers between 7,000 and 8,000 people who aren't citizens of this country. I mean, in the place that has anti-union laws built in and people are pushing for them all the time, the strength of people who've come together to create, you know, this contract that covers thousands of people. It's one of the largest contracts in the state. That's huge. I mean, it's a huge victory. And I mean, you know, in the anti-immigrant climate of North Carolina, especially in the short time that I've lived here and presumably before, to have a union of, you know, made up predominantly, maybe 99% or more, of immigrants is also like another really huge thing. It just shows the strength of spirit and the strength of like coming together and how people can create change. So, you know, I think it's holding those victories close and thinking about them as a motivation and a continuous drive is what's really important. Some of the changes that I think can be made, I mean, there's a lot. Luckily, when you're in a state where there's a long way to go, there's lots of opportunities, right? But even looking at North Carolina, that we have a lot of protections here for workers that states, you know, that neighboring states don't have. So that's also really important. I think victories for the National Farm Worker Ministry are helping supporters realize that drive within themselves to go out and, you know, drive the extra mile, as it were, or, you know, sometimes literally, to have people participate in the processes which create these change, whether, you know, there are legislative changes which accompany union contracts, you know, together, it's really powerful. So, you know, I feel like every person that gets involved and that gets, like, emboldened by what they're hearing and what they're learning and enough to create the drive within them to do things, you know, to have presentations within their church or to go and participate in Reynolds shareholders meeting. You know, new people all the time are participating. And so I think, like, from the National Farm Worker Ministry's perspective, that's a success, that more and more people are learning and that they're taking that learning and they're putting it into action. You know, in terms of the union, there are still lots of farm workers who would benefit from contract. And so successes would obviously be, you know, the Reynolds campaign, like winning a contract that would cover all the people that are working in tobacco. That would be huge. You know, we talked about yesterday with the group that was there how tobacco is, you know, from what I've heard, people kind of have their most loathed crop to pick and then the one that they mind the least. You know, it's like chores, right? Like everybody has their chore that they're like, yeah, I can tolerate this, or the ones that they just hate to do, you know? And so regardless of what that is, tobacco physically might not be quite as bad as other ones. Like I've heard strawberries are terrible because they're so small and it takes forever. But the reality of tobacco is it's a naturally occurring toxic substance. And so that makes it just one more level of difficult and dangerous. And then I heard a couple years ago from some people that work at an organic farm that they almost wish that the farm hadn't gone organic because the pesticides also have what they call it, sucker suppressants. So in like in the flowers and in the tobacco leaves, there are suckers that come up and you have to tear them off with your hand, which this can't see, you know, but so you tear them off with your hand, and if it's organic, there aren't the suppressant, there's not the chemical in there to suppress those, so it's actually harder work. So it's a double-edged sword, you know, but the point of all that is, especially in a crop and a harvest like tobacco, having people covered by a contract, that they're not going to be afraid to be fired because they're not getting enough wages, or, you know, because they're not being paid for the hours that they're working, or because, you know, the conditions where they're staying are absolutely inhumane, and or, you know, a myriad of things, like people feeling the protections of those contracts to allow them to do their work in a way that's safe and healthy and dignified is huge. So it's as simple and as difficult as that, I think.
Yeah. Simple and difficult.
Right.
So Alex, today, what would you like to say to people who might be interested in getting involved with the work of the National Farm Worker Ministry. Actually, hold on 1 second. I want to see if I can...
See if you can hear?
Hear them talking.
Okay. Yeah. Should we go...
Let's move rooms.
Okay.
For the record, our office is a little noisy, and we can hear the people talking in the office next to us. So we'll be right back.